Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 5, is brought to you by Stamps.com, Blue Apron, and Latote. Make sure you listen in for these spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. And a reminder to listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on the program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that. Research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
The successful reconstruction and prosecution of a crime, any crime, depends on a few things. Documenting the details quickly and accurately, capturing witness statements as soon as possible, and of course, gathering any and all physical evidence in a way that doesn't taint it. In other words, the successful prosecution of a crime depends largely on how the police handle things immediately after the commission of a crime, meaning the prosecutors have to rely on the police to get these basic things right so they can then build a criminal case against the defendants. It gets much trickier, though, when the defendants are the police themselves, like in the death of Freddie Gray. So it was the job of the Baltimore City Police to collect the information and evidence to not only help investigators figure out how Freddie was injured and died, but also ultimately help prosecute their own officers. How and when they collected and documented the evidence could help make or break the state's case against them. Now, it's important to distinguish sources of evidence from actual physical evidence itself. In this case, the sources were a handful: witness statements, police statements and documentation, the police van, the CCTV cameras, and the autopsy report. And the actual physical evidence pulled from those sources was even less: blood from inside the van and a knife allegedly found on Freddie Gray. Today we examine the veracity of this physical evidence, the blood and the knife, and the sources that they came from. Hi and welcome to episode 5 of Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan Story, and I'm joined as always with my colleagues Amelia McDonald Perry, Justine Barron, and Marsha Chatlin.
Once Freddie Gray was found unconscious in the back of the police van, that van became a crime scene. This is protocol. Whenever a death or major injury occurs in police custody, it is supposed to kick off an immediate criminal investigation. Every police expert and Baltimore cop that we talked with confirmed this. The criminal investigation is distinguished from an administrative investigation that looks at whether or not officers follow police procedure. So, around 10 a.m. on the morning of Freddie's arrest, just after he was sent to the hospital, Lieutenant Rice was heard on the KGA radio. He asked dispatch, "Did the crime lab respond to the station in reference to an arrest on Mountain Presbury?" After some confusion, Rice told the dispatcher he was going to call her on the landline, which he did. "This line's recording," she told him. He said, "Over here, for a potential death." Just before noon, a technician named Jennifer Anderson from the city's crime scene unit arrived at the scene. As she testified at trial, she was instructed to do one thing, and one thing only: take pictures of the van. On cross-examination, Porter's defense attorney pressed her on this. "And Lieutenant Norris was the person who was overseeing what he thought was appropriate to document. Is that correct?" "That's correct," she responded. Lieutenant Norris was the commander of the force investigation team. "Sometimes," she said, "crime scene techs do collaborate with officers to determine what evidence to pull. But in this particular instance, yes, Lieutenant Norris told me to just take pictures." A former police officer described the practice of just getting pictures after an injury in custody as CYA work. That's a technical term. It stands for cover your ass. "They get your face, sometimes the victim's face, the vehicle," he told me, "just enough to show that nothing serious has happened." Okay, but that doesn't sound like a criminal investigation. You might think that, in this case, there was no need to test the van for DNA or fingerprints. There's no whodunit mystery. We know Freddie was in that van. We know who put him there. I've heard this argument. But the police did think it was important to test the van for DNA. Not that day, but 7 days later, on April 20th, the day after Freddie Gray's death. Another crime tech, Thomas Wissner, was called to police headquarters that day to collect possible blood swabs from the right side of the van. Wissner did not collect any fingerprints. He was not instructed to do so. The defense jumped all over this as a major oversight. So in other words, your friendly neighborhood crime scene investigators in Baltimore are not hitting the scene and brilliantly unraveling the mystery like you might have seen on television. The limits of their evidence collection seems to be determined by the officers overseeing the investigation. I spoke with Sandra Guerra Thompson of the University of Houston Law Center. She wrote a book called Cops in Lab Coats. She described how crime scene units that are part of the police department face these kind of issues. She advocates for independent civilian-run crime labs.
Those standard operating procedures should be consistent with reliable scientific techniques, and that's really what should be governing what these investigators do. So if you have a properly accredited, well-functioning crime scene unit, then the investigators themselves should know what steps they're supposed to take, what it is they're looking. Now, this is an area where they need to know something about the crime in order to make determinations of what kind of evidence to collect and where to look and how to find it and, that sort of thing. And so they have to necessarily work hand in hand with the police investigators, but the crime scene people ideally would be civilians who are independent of the police department and who are accredited, working in an accredited organization and following standard operating procedures. There are an awful lot of labs, whether they're medical examiners or others, who have for a long time viewed their role as helping the police, helping the prosecution, and it's very dangerous.
Two more specialists were called to testify about their roles in testing the van, a serologist who studies blood evidence and a DNA expert who identified some of it as belonging to Freddie Gray. He located Freddie's blood in three places, on the second seat out of five, the wall behind the same seat, and two parts of the seatbelt. During the trial, these crime scene specialists went on and on and on about all the different samples they collected and analyzed. It was tedious, but I hoped there would be a payoff later. I thought we might glean from the blood evidence something about the mystery of how Freddie Gray died. I thought of the documentary, The Staircase, where the two sides debated the meaning of the pattern of blood splatter. Was there a lot of blood in this case, I wondered? Was there a splatter pattern? The payoff never came. In her closing statement in Porter's trial, prosecutor Janice Bledsoe argued that Freddie's blood was found where Porter said he put him, in a seat, at stop four. Porter said he was healthy at stop four. So, what, the blood evidence indicated otherwise? But Freddie was also described as sitting at stop one. Witnesses had said the cops used force there, so how do we know the blood didn't come from stop one? Not only that, the paramedic said that Freddie didn't have any significant bleeding when he was taken out of the van at stop six, just some seepage from his nose. She thought maybe he'd overdosed as a result. Porter also said that he saw no blood on Freddie. Huh. And not only that, the autopsy doesn't mention anything about the blood evidence at all. The blood was analyzed while the autopsy was being completed. The autopsy report includes a narrative theory of Freddie's death that describes his movements in the van without relying on any of the physical evidence of his movements in the van. Sometimes we have to ask, what is going on here? The van was photographed on the 12th and then, about a week later, tested for Freddie's blood. When Thomas Wissner went to test the van for DNA on the 20th, he said he met it at the central processing bed at police headquarters. Actually, it was just arriving too. He couldn't provide any information about where the van had been that week, when it was taken out of service, if it was taken out of service. In this case, it wasn't. Sure, normally, in a case like Freddie's, he said, the van would be towed to the processing bed immediately to to prevent contamination and establish a chain of evidence. This didn't happen here. The defense attorney pointed out the obvious. How can you trust blood evidence where there's no chain of custody? This is one of those moments in the trials where the defense, which represented the police officers under indictment, went after the Baltimore Police Department for failing to do an appropriate investigation. Meanwhile, the prosecution supported the evidence the police gave them. We generally think of Marilyn Mosby as going after cops, but it's really not that simple. The defense is very critical of BPD in the trials, and the state's attorney's office relies on some of BPD's evidence. Anyway, more than one police officer I spoke with was surprised and disappointed to hear that the van was not taken into evidence right away in this case. It's a sign that something was not kosher with the Freddie Gray investigation. Before Anthony Batts was the police commissioner, criminal investigations of in-custody deaths or injury were handled by homicide detectives. Internal Affairs handled the administrative investigations. Batts did away with this model and established a force investigation team in 2014. It was a Department of Justice model that Rodriguez had brought over from Los Angeles. As we will see throughout this case, the force investigation team wasn't always so clear and effective in practice. When the first crime scene unit came down and was instructed to only take pictures, it was almost as if the police weren't conducting a criminal investigation at all. Crime tech Jennifer Anderson said as much in court. The defense asked, "When you reported on April 12, 2015, no one said a crime has occurred. They said we want you to come out and document things for the purpose of our investigation. Is that correct?" "That's correct," she answered. I spoke with a retired Baltimore homicide supervisor who had overseen similar in-custody death and injury investigations under the previous model before Batts. He explained that a legitimate, thorough investigation benefits victims and officers. I'm not convinced that the previous system didn't have issues, but at least he describes a foundation of actual criminal investigation. Many vehicles have black boxes that provide data about recent driving, like the vehicle's history of braking. This could have been helpful in determining whether or not there is any sudden impact or a rough ride. He said he would have brought in the department's accident investigation unit to help. Actually, he said, that's policy. Unfortunately, like most of our police sources, this retired officer isn't willing to go on the record. Surprising how many officers and others in criminal justice are willing to speak out about this case at all ranks, but only off the record. Many of them see the same issues we do, but they won't risk their jobs, relationship, or political capital, even when they're retired. Baltimore is a big liberal city in theory. In practice, it could feel like a reactionary small town. They call it Smaltimore. We hope to see more pictures of the van and blood evidence. We also hope to see run sheets that would have told us when the van was put back into service. We submitted a formal Public Information Act request to BPD. We were promised thousands of pages of documents around the end of 2016. Then they pulled the plug on this request earlier this year, citing an ongoing federal investigation into the Freddie Gray case. A federal investigation of cops under the Trump administration? We're pursuing this matter. It has been 2 years since Freddie's arrest. So much is still withheld from the public. We get CCTV videos, but not all of them. We get documents, but not all of them. They don't mind us having information. They mind us having all of it.
So here's the thing. I have never exactly been a fashionista because, face it, when you're pleasantly plump like me, it's not always fun shopping at stores where finding clothing that both fits well and is stylish can be really challenging. More often than not, I've found in my life I have left frustrated from stores empty-handed. But now there's a better way, and you don't have to step a foot in any store to get a wardrobe tailored for you that is stylish and ever-changing. It's a service called Le Tote, a fashion subscription box that sends you brand name clothing accessories right to your door. With Le Tote, you can rent your look and you get new clothes confidence every single day. Here's how it works. It's $39 a month. You get as many totes as you want. You wear them, return, and repeat. It's so easy to do. You go onto the website, you fill out your style profile, you pick the kinds of things that really speak to you, the kind of looks that you like, the way that you would like to look, and they put together your outfits with accessories that you love, and they'll send them to you right to your door. Jewelry, handbags, blouses, bottoms, dresses, for every style, every size, and every shape. So go to letote.com. That's L-E-Tote. T-O-T-E.com and get started for as low as $39 a month and enter promo code UA to get 50% off your first month. Fill out your style profile and sign up to get a custom tote delivered to your door. It's that convenient. You never have to step foot in a store again. You wear what you want, return everything in the mail when you're done, and you'll get a new box within days. Again, that's letote.com. Enter my code UA and feel fabulous with fashion delivered right to your door.
Freddie Gray may have ultimately been charged for possession of a switchblade, but video evidence suggests that the officers involved in his arrest were after something else entirely. Drugs. Sandtown Winchester is one of the many areas in Baltimore where CDS, or controlled dangerous substances like heroin and other opiates, are sold at a high volume. While testifying at his own trial in December 2015, Officer Porter called it the heroin capital of the East Coast. In Baltimore, simple possession of a small amount of CDS, even heroin, is a fairly minor offense, incurring minimal, if any, jail time, with some exceptions, of course. But get caught exchanging money for drugs or with enough drugs in your possession to meet the bar for intent to distribute, and the penalty could be far more serious. There are surely those police officers who are focused on their arrest stats, but overall, jailing dealers until they make bail or confiscating their stash doesn't have any lasting effect. The dealers will just re-up their stash, either at their expense or the expense of whoever's above them, and move to another corner. The real benefit to having a dealer in custody is leveraging the threat of major jail time to get intel on those who wouldn't set foot on Mount Street selling peewees or G-packs. So dealers who want to stay in business, out of jail, and away from pressure to snitch, do their best to distance themselves from the drugs they're selling. Not everyone who deals drugs in Baltimore congregates in alleyways or in front of corner stores, but those that do may work in pairs, with one person as the money guy, soliciting customers and handling the cash, while the other is the hitter, handling distribution from the ground stash. The communication with each other and even the buyers isn't usually obvious, though. In 2015, a George Mason University graduate student named Ajima Oliger published a dissertation on why and how crime events routinely occur at specific places in high-crime areas, using Baltimore as a case study, and largely focused on drug arrests. The entire thing is 223 pages of data analysis based on her observations of over 300 hours worth of CCTV footage. BPD and the City Watch program granted her access to selected footage from 2010 to 2011, as well as their facilities. Jealous. The material is dry and super academic-y, as I assume dissertations are supposed to be, but many of Oliger's observations capture what I'm talking about. Here's how she describes two dealers seen working together and using the stairs to a row house as their base. The dealer kept a distance from the targets, never speaking directly face-to-face or making direct contact. Instead, the first dealer followed the targets after the initial contact and then led them back to the second dealer, where money was left on the top stair, which the second dealer collected. Even those dealers who work alone don't carry around their stash if they don't have to, especially if there's enough to warrant an intent to distribute charge. Instead, they hide the stash in a nearby location, tucked inside an old rolled-up rug abandoned on the street, inside an empty bag of Doritos and stuffed up a drain pipe, and straight up buried in the dirt. Those are just some of the hiding places we've come across in our review of dozens of probable cause reports and charging statements during this investigation. There's a lot to say about Freddie Gray's run-ins with the law over the course of his short life, so we'll be tackling the subject in a future episode. But it's important to note that three of Freddie's arrests in the 5 months prior to his death linked him to a ground stash discovered within a block of Gilmore Homes.
He was arrested twice for possession and intent to distribute in December 2014. On March 19, 2015, he was only charged with simple possession. In the probable cause statement for that case, Officer Gabriel Romolo describes seeing Freddie run back and forth to a suspected ground stash location on the 1800 block of Mount Street. Romolo eventually uncovered the stash, but because Freddie was never caught with it in his possession or making a sale, he could only be charged for the two oxycodone allegedly found in his pocket. Freddie was never convicted in either of these cases, by the way. The first two cases from December were thrown out by prosecutors, and the third, he died before his scheduled court date. Coincidentally, just a few days before Freddie's last arrest, the director of the Crime Strategies Unit at the state's attorney's office emailed the Western District Commander about increasing police presence at the intersection of Mount Street and North Avenue, specifically to target drug dealing. On March 20th, BPD's Osborne Robinson forwarded the email to his unit supervisors, including Lieutenant Brian Rice, and instructed them to immediately begin conducting a daily narcotics initiative in the area. Was this the reason Rice, Miller, and Nero decided to chase Freddie on April 12th? To be clear, I actually don't think that Freddie was selling drugs that morning. Having reviewed his criminal case files, including those cases in which he was convicted, I don't believe his behavior that day fits the bill. At trial, the prosecution submitted into evidence 23 seconds of video from a Metropolitan Transit Authority surveillance camera on the corner of North Avenue in Pennsylvania. This camera caught a few seconds of Freddie, Devontae Rory, and their other friend Brandon Ross walking west at 8:35 a.m., just 5 minutes before the foot chase started. The three guys appear to be on their way somewhere, walking with a purpose. According to Brandon, they were supposed to see a guy about some construction work. On those occasions when Freddie was arrested for intent to sell, he was never with Brandon and Devontae. It's not that he was always arrested alone, but there was minimal interaction between Freddie and the people he was alleged to be selling drugs with. That's the point, remember? Selling drugs is not like setting up a lemonade stand on the front lawn with your two best friends, shooting the breeze in between sales. Here's how our addendum host, author and former Baltimore drug dealer D. Watkins, put it in his book, The Cookup.
Everybody has a breaking point. And even dudes who have been tested fold. A stranger could take 30 years for you while your best friend is in the next room ratting, crying, gargling on his own snot while explaining the whole operation. The no snitching thing is a facade, and it's evident when you look at the incarceration rates. The street corner retention ratio is too low to be building lifelong relationships and unbreakable bonds. Y'all could be on today and off tomorrow. I'd even argue that it's better to work with strangers just in case you have to throw them out of a window one day. Who would you rather throw out of a window? Some Comcast nigga or your childhood best friend? I know Guy ran through multiple crews and Bip had a new clique like every 2 months. It wasn't about being a real friend or a fake one. It's just that jail and death were guaranteed and you had to survive. You had to focus on you. Selling dope is a team game on the surface, but you're really alone. The game is like dodgeball. You start with a team and you want to protect them, but that's not always the case as things move along. People will be hit, and finishing with the cash you started with is a rarity. You really have to be able to stand on your own in the midst of the 10, 20, 50 employees and friends that surround you every day. Some quit and some expire, but the game doesn't give a shit. Losing friends hurts, and thick skin is needed. There are no therapists on the street, and pain is only mended with music, sex, pills, yak, weed, and the shit that we're out there selling.
If you listen to Undisclosed, which you do because you're here, obviously, then you probably cook with Blue Apron. And if you don't, then you should. Here's why. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Me, Rabia, Colin, Susan, all of us at Undisclosed have been cooking with Blue Apron for almost a year now, and we don't plan to stop using it anytime soon. The meals are delicious, they're easy and fun to cook, and cooking them makes you feel like a real chef. Seriously, they look all fancy and colorful when you're done cooking them, and the dishes have exotic names like baby broccoli and fontina paninis with hard-boiled egg and arugula salad. Then there's sweet and sour salmon with bok choy, carrot, and ginger fried rice. I was basically a microwave chef before Blue Apron, and now I'm so much more confident in my cooking ability. I don't need to go to a fancy restaurant to get a great meal, because for under $10 a person and in less than an hour, I can make something great at home. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Nothing about Freddie or his friend's behavior suggests they were trying to work a ground stash just after 8:30 a.m. on the Lord's Day, but everything else indicates Lieutenant Brian Rice was itching to find one. For starters, there's the matter of Rice's disappearance behind the houses on Presbury Street at 8:40 and 32 seconds, just after Freddie was taken into custody. That's the first of only two appearances made by Rice on the CCTV footage from that stop. He's gone for just shy of 4 minutes, returning only as the transport van's doors are being shut with Freddie inside. What was Rice doing? According to the back and forths heard on the police dispatch audio, Rice was looking for the second suspect and requested backup units respond to 1707 North Mount Street, just up the block from where Freddie was arrested. But that's a completely different location than where we saw Rice disappear, by the way. While the area behind the houses on Presbury could also be described as being behind the houses on Mount Street, it's the even side of the street. 1707 Mount is, however, on the same side of the street as the lot where, at just after 8:43, three uniformed officers can be seen pacing on CCTV Cam 1B. Remember those guys? We talked about them in Episode 3, during our review of just some of the strange stuff seen on the cams at Stop 1. The officers are very clearly staring at flat ground, definitely searching for something. But a second suspect? Nah. Remember, the only other suspect we know about is Freddie's friend Devante, who evaded capture by dashing into one of the apartment buildings on the Baker Street side of Gilmore Homes. He was only ahead of Freddie by 8 seconds, though, and should have been seen by any one of the three bike cops who were in pursuit. And if he wasn't, well, there is still nowhere for a grown man to hide in either location. Not behind the houses on Presbury, which is littered with trash and broken tree branches, or the empty flat lot on Mount. Unless Rice thought he might have shapeshifted into a gopher. Nevertheless, searching for the second suspect was the story, and all the officers involved stuck to it. Sort of. Even though Rice only requested one backup unit, according to the dispatch audio, two officers, Mark Gladhill and William Porter, responded that they were on their way. A third, Officer Zachary Novak, only notified dispatch when he was on scene. And we know a fourth officer, Ricardo Alvarado, also responded, but he's never heard on the police radio. He didn't testify, and any statement he likely gave to investigators has not been released. What we do know is that Porter claimed he was directed by Rice to search for the other suspect behind the houses on Presbury after he parked his patrol car on Westwood and Bruce Streets. Novak also acknowledged in his various trial testimonies that he helped search for the elusive second suspect, but was less clear about the location. Still, it seems likely that he and Alvarado are two of the three uniformed officers seen walking around in circles on Cam 1B. Gladhill, however, never mentioned searching for anyone or anything in either his statement to investigators on April 26th or while testifying at the Porter trial. This is extra strange because Gladhill actually refers to the search a second time on the dispatch audio, asking if he's needed in the rear anymore. Plus, through process of elimination, Gladhill is the only other officer reported to be at Stop 1 who could plausibly be walking around the lot at that time, according to the official timeline. Maybe he forgot. The CCTV footage of the three cops pacing around on Mount Street was completely ignored at trial. It's easy to miss at first glance, and I have no reason to believe prosecutors ever gave the CCTV footage much more attention than that. But still, everyone involved in this case, from the defendants to the investigators to the lawyers on both sides of the aisle, went out of their way to avoid discussing whether drugs were a factor, even when debating the legality of Freddie's initial detainment. No one has ever questioned the veracity of Rice's claim that he was hunting for a second suspect, let alone offered any other plausible explanation for what he and the other officers were actually searching for.
Officers Miller and Narrow then placed Mr. Gray in a seated position and subsequently found a knife clipped to the inside of his pants pocket. The blade of the knife was folded into the handle. The knife was not a switchblade and is lawful under Maryland law.
These officers. New developments this noon coming out of Baltimore. A second police officer now claims that the knife that Freddie Gray had on the day of his arrest was illegal. But Maryland State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby disagrees. She says Gray never should have been arrested in the first place. But if those officers are right and the knife was illegal, it will have an impact on the case.
When I hear discussion about the knife allegedly found in Freddie Gray's possession, I am reminded of the confusion surrounding California's Prop 8 in 2008. If you voted no on Prop 8, then you were voting in favor of marriage equality, and vice versa. Some have argued that Prop 8 was written in a confusing way by design, to fool liberal-minded people into voting yes, or to confuse people out of voting altogether. Was the debate around the Freddie Gray knife with its legal and illegal switchblades, city, county, state codes, confusing by design? At the least, the confusion has benefited many of the involved players. And nobody is working that hard to clear it up. The good news is that the knife's legality is the least confusing thing about it. It's very simple. Here's Zan Martin, an expert in knife law, to explain.
The knife is what the knife is. There should have been no hesitation about the ruling of the knife from the get-go. The knife is a legal knife. The knife was never in any hazard of being anything other than a legal knife.
So Mosby was right. The knife was legal and the arrest was wrongful. And yet her office allowed the defense team and media to skew the story in the other direction, to shame her, basically, for getting it wrong. In 4 months of trials, the prosecution didn't raise the knife issue once. So how is the knife legal, and why did Mosby's team not pursue this issue more forcefully?
As we all know, the Freddie Gray case played out over four separate trials between December 2015 and July 2016. What you might not realize is that a lot of the case played out in nearly 400 motions and counter motions. Through these motions, the knife was played out of contention as an issue that could be introduced at trial. From early motions, we learned that the state had shifted its strategy around the arrest. In May 2015, they wrote, quote, Mr. Gray was arrested prior to the discovery of the knife in his pocket, such that the legality of the knife is largely immaterial, except to rebut any claims the defendants may raise about their beliefs and the reasonableness of those beliefs. Officer Nero's defense jumped all over the statement. They used it to justify a motion to preclude any reference to the knife in Nero's trial. In that motion, the defense quoted Baltimore City law, which states that it's unlawful to possess, quote, any knife with an automatic spring or other device for opening and or closing the blade, commonly known as a switchblade knife. Then they added, even if the knife were legal, let's just say, the state has continued to prosecute people for possession of switchblades. They attached case records of recent knife arrests as proof. Most of these cases have a disposition of null prosequi, meaning the state didn't actually prosecute them. However, all the charges were approved by the state's attorney's charging division. The defense subpoenaed seven assistant state's attorneys from that division. All of this amounted to a kind of legal blackmail. If the state were to loudly and firmly prove that the knife in this case was legal, how many arrests for similar knives would be subject to scrutiny? This strategy by the defense may have worked. The state had a good case to make about the knife, but barely responded to the motion. Lead prosecutor Michael Schatzow later admitted that they didn't fight the knife issue, so it never came up once during the trials. Now, some of this was reported, but none of it was decipherable to the media or public because we never saw the knife. There was one moment in Kevin Moore's footage of the arrest released to the media, in which Officer Miller is seen picking up a shiny object and putting it into his pocket. Some commentators suggested that this was the knife. It had to be somewhere, right?
Finally, when the trials ended and the gag order was lifted, we got to see the knife, In October 2016, WBAL News released pictures of it, which they obtained from the state's attorney's office. The knife has a bright blue marbled collar and a hook at the end. It doesn't look like the silver object that Miller is picking up in Kevin Moore's video. That looked more like a phone. 2 weeks later, the defense leaked a video to a different local TV station. In it, Detective Danielle Taylor, lead investigator on the case, conducts a demonstration with the knife, showing that it is spring-assisted. The video was leaked with more case files of knife arrests. The defense referenced this video in motions as proof that the knife was an illegal switchblade. This video is posted to our YouTube page. You may remember Detective Taylor from the last episode. She made the video about the van shaking, too. So we got a picture of the knife from the state, then a video demonstration from the defense. We got the usual fragmented, passive-aggressive morsels that officials fed to the public in this case. And since the world is not made up of knife experts, the media did not discuss what it all meant. Mostly, they took the defense's word for it. Look, a switchblade. This was the material that I brought to knife expert Zan Martin. The picture, the video, the Baltimore and Maryland codes. I begged for clarity. Zan took me into his showroom deep in the heart of Orange County, California, where he collects historical knives by night and provides expert testimony and training by day. He gave me the clarity I needed.
Switchblades, by definition, is a knife that opens at a push of a button, whether it's a button, a slide, a toggle, or a lever. Now, there is a traditional switchblade, and that's one where the blade of the knife is actually holding a long, narrow piece of metal that's cut down the middle and shaped like a very tight V. Now, this is set into the knife itself, and when the blade is folded, it compresses the arms of this V-shaped spring together to create a tension. Now, a separate spring forces a pin into a hole at the base of the blade and locks it into place.
Zan is very passionate about knives. The layman's version is that in a switchblade, the knife is held closed by a spring. That's the V. If you think about a spring, like a toilet paper dispenser roll or a mouse trap, it's compressed until it is released, at which point it opens fully, quickly. It only has two positions. The spring mechanism inside of a switchblade makes it open suddenly. By the 1950s, with the introduction of the stiletto model, switchblades were seen as dangerous. The stiletto is the knife from the movies at the time, James Dean movies, or what the jets and the sharks are waving at each other while they're dancing. Its blade pops out of the front of the knife in case you need to cut someone quickly. Public paranoia around the stiletto led to the Federal Switchblade Act of 1958, making most switchblades illegal. They are still illegal in some jurisdictions, like Baltimore City. The knife in the Freddie Gray case is not a switchblade. It's not an old-fashioned folding knife either. The knife in question didn't exist in 1958. It's called an assisted opener, and it was invented in 1998. Instead of a button, assisted openers have what are known as thumb studs attached to the side or the back of the blade that allow you to open them with one hand. A thumb stud, it's like a doorknob. It helps open the door, but you still have to do the work. Assisted openers are cheaper and safer than switchblades, so they're very popular, dominating the market by far. The assisted part comes from the torsion bar inside of the knife.
When you overcome a certain amount, a certain degree ratio, the blade then engages the torsion bar and opens to its only other position, open.
That resistance is called a bias towards closure. Switchblades have a bias towards opening. I know this is highly technical, but it's also important. There is a radical amount of confusion about these knives that affects policing in Baltimore and around the country. All of these technical details get debated, but sometimes incorrectly. The torsion bar is often referred to as a spring.
Now, in this particular case, it's been acknowledged that there is a spring-type mechanism. What that in fact is a torsion bar holding it shut. There is no mechanism external. There is no external button, lever, or toggle So what they're referencing is an assisted opening knife. It is not a switchblade because there is no switch. There is no spring compressed with a lock that is the trigger that opens with a bias toward opening.
There is no spring. There is Correct. A spring-like device, is what you meant.
Even that's misleading, and yeah. I said that only as a way of entering it into the conversation.
Why they're saying it.
Why they are Got saying it. Is a spring-like device. It's right. not a spring at all.
Even though assisted openers don't technically have a spring, they are commonly recognized as spring-assisted. That is what they are called in Baltimore. That is even what the state's attorney's office refers to this knife as. And that is the language used in countless case files. So let's concede the debate around the torsion bar and call the assisted opener knife spring assisted. This is where people get confused with Baltimore City switchblade law. Here it is again. It shall be unlawful for any person to sell, carry, or possess any knife with an automatic spring or other device for opening and/or closing the blade, commonly known as a switchblade knife. Is this really that confusing once you break it down? First, assisted openers are not commonly known as switchblades. They are not known as switchblades under the federal definition. The Federal Switchblade Act was amended by President Obama in 2009 to clarify that it does not include any knife with a bias towards closure. It doesn't include assisted openers. Assisted openers are not commonly known as switchblades by retailers, from knife shops to Walmart. They are usually categorized with folding knives and sold legally. As far as I can tell, assisted openers are only commonly known as switchblades among Baltimore police officers looking for a reason to arrest someone. That's circular logic, and it's unjust. So, an assisted opener, or spring-assisted knife, is not commonly known as a switchblade. But you know what? Let's just concede that anyway, just for kicks. The rest of the city's switchblade law still doesn't apply. Assisted openers do not have an automatic spring or other device that opens or closes the blade. They have a device that assists with opening faster, but you still have to open it yourself and close it yourself. The city's law may seem vaguer or more complicated than most knife laws, but any way you look at it, the knife allegedly belonging to Freddie Gray is a legal assisted opener. The state released the pictures of the knife after the trials, probably hoping someone would notice. Unfortunately, the criminal justice system is behind on this law. According to the charging documents, Officer Miller arrested Freddie Gray for possessing a, quote, spring-assisted, one-hand-operated knife. There's nothing about spring-assisted or one-handed in the code. The case files of Miller and his colleagues are filled with such issues. I see arrests for one-handed folding knives and fixed-blade knives. There are no laws restricting possession of those. I asked a few former Baltimore police officers if they received any training on the difference between legal and illegal knives. They all said no. We were provided with access to some internal documents, a stack of switchblade knife arrests from 2015, some of which were used in the motion to preclude the knife. We also got to see pictures of the knives in these cases. Not one of these is a picture of a switchblade. They are all legal pocket knives or assisted openers. So all of these people were wrongfully arrested. They lost time from family and work, lost money to bail bondsmen. Some faced parole penalties. Many of these people were not committing other crimes when they were searched, like Freddie Gray. In 2015, a young African-American man was walking along railroad tracks, like young people do. He was arrested for trespassing and searched. He had a knife on him. The picture in his file shows a legal assisted opener, a small camouflage army knife. He was found guilty. The application of weapon law is highly racialized. A pocket knife in the hands of one person can be seen as a work tool, as protection, or as a beloved father's army knife. In the hands of a young man of color taking a walk along the tracks, it can be seen as dangerous. Thank you.
Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using just your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage, and Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. You can create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. Just click, print, mail, and you're done. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. I use Stamps.com because there are never enough hours in the week, and if I can save that 30 minutes here, 30 minutes there that I used to use to go to the post office, it allows me to accomplish so much more. And now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage, and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com, enter undisclosed. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again.
When I first heard that the Freddie Gray case involved an accusation of a knife, my mind traveled all the way back in time, to the 1890s. When a stereotype of African Americans and razors emerged as African Americans moved into large cities like Baltimore near the start of the 20th century. As African Americans asserted their rights for equal opportunity, white resistance gave birth to the most vile caricatures of blacks as criminals, conniving, and unfit for the responsibilities of freedom. One way that political cartoonists and newspaper writers, crime novelists, and later the makers of radio, film, and television stories registered their resistance to black freedom was by creating images of a razor-wielding miscreant, often from the South, who terrorized cities with their lawlessness and penchant for violence. The 1898 song, Dark Town Is Out Tonight, from E.E. Rice's Broadway production, Summer Nights, includes the lyrics, "So fetch your blazers, bring out your razors, Darktown is out tonight." The razor stereotype was also used to discredit black military participation. The song Razors in the War is about World War I. The song asks, "I don't suppose for a minute that any of you coons has got a razor." Black would-be soldiers ask, "If I join the army, can we use our razors in this war? If they let us use our razors in this war, we certainly cut the Germans to the core."
"Well, if I join the army, can we use our razors in this war?"
That's it, Captain. Can we use our razors?"
"Well, I don't know. I'll see about it. Get up." "If they let us use our razors in this war, we certainly call them Germans to the core. We ain't no advertisers, but there'll be no doggone Kaisers if they let us use our razors in this war."
The Baltimore Sun, as early as 1907, printed stories with headlines like, "Negro attacks four men slash wildly with razor in Washington Park. Man gets 6 years in razor holdups. And razor blade vendors says Negro stole stock in trade." Sociology textbooks often point to a study in which a group of white people were shown a picture of a white person holding a razor blade during an argument with a fellow subway rider in New York City. The participants in the study were shown the picture for a second and then asked to describe what they saw. More than half said they saw a black person holding a razor to a white person's throat. Our nation is a long way from World War I, but the passage of time hasn't changed the way that black people in cities are viewed by the press, by the police, and by the public.
The young man walking along the railroad tracks in 2015 was charged with carrying a switchblade. This has a fine of up to $500 and 1 year in prison. He was also charged with a dangerous weapon concealed on his person, which carries up to $1,000 and 3 years. These two charges are very commonly paired in Baltimore. Cops can also charge for intent to injure with a dangerous weapon. For that law, the statute says, the court shall impose the highest sentence of imprisonment prescribed. There is no absolute standard for proving intent. Under the Maryland statute, dangerous weapons are defined. They include only switchblades, mace, Bowie knives, razors, and a bunch of weapons you'd find in a Bruce Lee movie. They exclude pen knives that aren't switchblades, explicitly. But cops will use these laws to prosecute for practically anything. In the case files for Miller and Nero, there are charges for dangerous weapons that are not listed in the statute. In two separate cases in a few months, people threw bricks at other people. There are also cases involving stones, glass, blunt objects. None of these should have been called dangerous weapons. These are just assaults. Then there's one case, a neighborhood argument over clothing, that ended with someone pulling a sword from a sheath in his back pocket, and the other responding with a billy club. Well, that's Baltimore. I guess. Switchblades and dangerous weapon charges show up in about 8 to 10% of arrests for the officers in this case, so this is not as small an issue as many suggest. Ignorance of knife law, willful or otherwise, can have serious consequences. I'm not convinced that ignorance of the law applies in the case of Detective Danielle Taylor, who made that knife video. In the video, she manipulates the knife to make it seem like a switchblade. She points out the button and how quickly the knife opens when she's actually manually opening it. She presses on the blade when it's open, trying to prove a bias towards opening. This all reflects technical knowledge of the difference. As with the van shaking video, Taylor was the lead detective for the prosecutor's case against the officers, but she was creating material designed to help the defense. The state's attorney tried to get her removed from the case. We made our own videos, posted to our YouTube page. Zan and I demonstrate the difference between switchblades and assisted openers. It doesn't take any time at all to learn. While recent events have brought more attention to racial disparities in gun law enforcement, many people don't realize how seriously knife laws affect Black communities today, too. I spoke with Doug Ritter, the president of Knife Rights, a lobbying and advocacy group. They have used the courts and legislature to try to change knife arrest practices in New York City, where so-called gravity knives are the counterpart to Baltimore's switchblade confusion.
I mean, in New York City, we're talking somewhere between 60 and 70,000 people in the last decade being prosecuted for carrying common pocket knives of all sorts of descriptions that are certainly not gravity knives anywhere else but in New York State. These laws are often applied discriminatorily, which is what we see particularly in New York City, where over 85% of the arrests of people for carrying an illegal knife are people of color. This is something that should concern everybody. It's an incredible waste of resources that could be better put to be used for actually catching criminals, which is what they're supposed to be doing, not harassing innocent individuals who are simply carrying a tool in their pocket.
Have you been able to assess or do any kind of data collection around what percentage of these knife arrests are actually arrests for legal knives? It's hard, right? Because you have to see the pictures of the knives and such. Like, you have to...
Well, what we have seen in New York City, which is, if you want to call it, the knife arrest capital of the United States, is that virtually all of these arrests are for knives that would be considered perfectly legal anywhere else. The city has stretched the definition of an illegal knife to cover common pocket knives. I can't recall seeing a single incident where I have actually viewed the knife that was the subject of the arrest that it wasn't or wouldn't have normally been a perfectly legal knife.
Doug Ritter also pointed out how ineffective knife laws are in preventing the small amount of knife violence that does happen.
Knife fights, if you will, weren't particularly common in the 50s. It was Hollywood's portrayal of gangs and knives and automatic knives, switchblades being used in those fights, that got us where we are today with the switchblade bands that do exist. It was never a huge problem. And we know when we look at police reports and others that the vast majority of crimes actually committed to another person with a knife are committed with kitchen knives. And they're almost entirely the result of some sort of domestic disturbance.
Ultimately, Doug Ritter and the activists aim to abolish laws like New York City's gravity ban and Baltimore's switchblade ban, while also fighting illegal enforcement. Possession of knives that are not commonly associated with crimes and legal through most of the country, including the next jurisdiction over, should not be penalized, they say.
The legality of the knife was maybe one of the state's more solid points in the case against the officers. So why did they switch their arrest strategy from the knife to one focused on a questionable Terry stop, which is actually so hard to prove? One possible reason is that the grand jury dropped Mosby's original false imprisonment charges. Maybe that spooked them. Also, as noted earlier, the defense blackmailed them with examples of recent wrongful switchblade charges, approved by their own charging division. Another reason might have been Supreme Court precedent. The defense cited Helen v. North Carolina in their motion to preclude the knife. The court gives police officers the latitude to be reasonably mistaken in their understanding of the law. So Miller could have been excused for not knowing the knife was legal based on his reasonable suspicion that it wasn't. He wasn't trained. The same does not apply to civilians. We are told that ignorance of the law is no excuse. It will be interesting to see if Mosby puts up a stronger fight in the officer's civil case against her. She's being sued for defamation of character, in part for accusing them of getting the knife law wrong, which they did. Will she be willing to risk exposing and reforming the city's knife arrest practices this time to help herself?
The state's attorney's office might have known more about the knife than just its legality. At the press conference after the trials were dismissed, prosecutor Michael Schatzow said this.
The knife, and I wish I had the picture with me, but, you know, during one day after the charges were brought, the defense wanted to bring their experts to see the van that was parked in the basement of police headquarters. And so we sent somebody, Sarah Akhtar, over there to do it. And she came back with this photograph of an advertisement. In the police headquarters, they were advertising with a BPD insignia on it, the very knife that Freddie Gray had on his possession.
So the state stipulated away any mention of the knife's legality from the trials, but publicly they hinted that they had information that it was planted? Did they leave all of their good stuff out of the trials? Later, in a statement responding to Danielle Taylor's video, they took it further. Quote, "The type of knife recovered was sold to police officers by the cop shop and was in possession of one of the defendants on the very day that Mr. Gray was arrested." So they have evidence that an officer had the same knife? Or the same type of knife, because that's a big difference. Anyway, if Miller or one of his fellow officers did plant this knife, it would reflect their ignorance. They picked a legal knife. We reached out to Mosby's office, asking them to elaborate. They replied that they could not participate with this project. I'm not saying that the knife was planted, but it does look like a cop knife. This particular kind of knife, the blue knife, is called a SARC, a search and rescue knife. It has a seatbelt cutter, which is the hook at the bottom, and a glass impactor button to break glass in an emergency. These are also called rescue or tactical knives. What would Freddie Gray need with a seatbelt cutter? Zan says that in the nearly 500 cases that he's testified at, he can only remember five in which civilians were found with SARC knives. But civilians can own SARC knives. I see some in the case files. They are sold around town, at Walmart and sporting goods stores, with the rest of the legal knives, because they're legal. Even more indicative is the knife's blue color. Sark knives are very commonly marketed to cops in blue, firefighters in red, and military in army green. As for the cop shop poster, records show that the state subpoenaed the cop shop, a store in downtown Baltimore that sells gear to first responders. They requested sales records related to rescue knives for the officers in this case. Schatzel mentioned that the knife on the poster had a BPD insignia. Yeah, I don't think the ASA saw the Freddie Gray knife on that poster. I've seen a bunch of Sark knives with BPD insignias online. They have the same shape as the blue knife in this case, but it's a standard Sark shape. The insignia knives are more upscale. It is more likely that the ASA recognized the shape of the knife and associated it with the blue knife, because it seems hardly anyone in the Baltimore criminal justice system understands knives. They just arrest, prosecute, fine, and jail people for them. I thought the cop shop knife was a red herring. Like I said, that kind of knife is available all over. Then I looked at the store's website. The site is down, but I found a cached version of it from around the time of Freddie Gray's arrest. There's a picture of their modest knife stock on a couple of shelves. There's one box that is unlabeled, just a white box. I asked Zan. He told me that it was a Chinese knockoff. If you look closely at the Freddie Gray knife, it does come from China. So, maybe.
So I stopped by the cop shop one morning while I was in Baltimore. I wanted to see what their knife stock was like. It looked exactly like what you might expect inside, like a man cave for weapon aficionados. Like inside a glass case, there was a stack of Hillary for Prison bumper stickers next to boxes of bullets. There was also a stock photo of state's attorney Marilyn Mosby, and it was stacked to the wall with a joke referencing a Snickers bar. It was clearly at her expense. I told the guy behind the counter that I was interested in seeing the knives they had available to purchase, and here's what he said. We stopped selling knives. Huh. I asked him why, and he said, no lie. We stopped selling them after Freddie Gray died. I hadn't planned on volunteering my real reasons for being curious about their knife stock, but I also didn't want to be deceptive. So I just explained myself. Well, now that you mention it, Freddie Gray is actually why I'm here. I started to explain that I was a reporter, but the cop shop guy completely cut me off. I don't mean to be rude, he said. By the way, that's never a good sign. But I hate you. I hate people like you. You media people never tell the truth. He introduced himself as the owner of the cop shop and proceeded to berate me, although not in a cruel way, about being a member of the evil mainstream media, which is full of lies, etc., etc. I tried being charming, but it didn't work. He refused to answer any of my questions and all but kicked me out of his store. But what happened next was weird. I was followed. A guy came quickly from around the corner from the same direction as the cop shop. He followed me several blocks across the street, stopping when I stopped, walking again when I walked. He didn't catcall me or anything. It was definitely not like that. Finally, I turned around and shouted at him, "Stop fucking following me, dude, seriously." He stopped, smiled, and turned down a random corner. My presence as a journalist must have caused a real stir at the cop shop at 10:30 in the morning.
Again, we are not suggesting that the Freddie Gray knife was planted or obtained at the cop shop. We are just following the state's attorney's leads, which are not clear. But probably the strongest suggestion in support of this can be seen in Kevin Moore's video. Miller bends down to pick up a silver object that looks like a cell phone. But what you might not see is that he already has a more slender object in his hand, one that does look a lot more like a pocket knife. It's not clear in the portion of the video released to the public, but it is clear in the full video. We've posted it to our YouTube page. You can clearly see the same object at different points, on the ground by the bikes, then on the ledge behind the bikes, then Miller seems to hand it over to the van driver with the silver phone. It looks like the size of a pocket knife, and it puts the knife at the arrest, but it does not look blue, like the Sark knife released publicly. It looks black. It's not that easy to see, but there's one point where all the other colors around it are popping, Miller's yellow taser, his silver cuffs, and this object blends into his black pants. If it were the blue knife, it seems like you would have been able to see the color. If this is a folding knife, as it appears, and if it's not the blue knife, was it swapped out for a spring-assisted knife that is still legal but more cops think is illegal? We're just asking. One of the complaints the defense made about the van evidence was that there was no chain of custody report. There was one for the knife. We obtained it from a source. The report lists each individual that checked out the knife from evidence, including the time and date, and when they returned it. Mostly, the knife was accessed by people on the force investigation team, especially Danielle Taylor, who made the video. There's one glaring issue in this report. On April 27th, while the task force was completing its investigation, the knife was transferred to Sarita Teal, also of the force investigation team. An hour later, it was returned by Zachary Novak. Teal checked it out again 10 minutes later. Zachary Novak, he wasn't on the FIT team or the task force. He was one of the patrol officers involved in the arrest. He helped load Freddie into the van at stop one. He took Freddie out of the van at the last stop. He was listed as a witness on Miller's arrest documents. Novak was as involved in what happened to Freddie Gray as the six officers who were charged. But he was given immunity from prosecution in exchange for his grand jury testimony. Novak shouldn't have been handling evidence. What was he doing with the knife? And why does he return it without ever checking it out first? Did he borrow it from Teal? Or obtain it somehow without checking it out? Novak has a relationship with this knife. He submitted it into evidence in the first place. On the night of the arrest, he brought it down to evidence at 9 p.m., just a couple hours before Miller submitted his charging documents. Why was a patrol officer and a witness in the case handling key evidence and given so much power and access? The plot thickens. Sometimes it thickens so much it's practically opaque.
The CCTV footage that Amelia has carefully scrutinized showed that the cops were desperately looking for drugs, but ended up finding none. But not to worry, because Freddie Gray had a knife, right? Reason enough to arrest him, because, well, they needed a reason. The problem, of course, was that if that knife actually existed and it was the same knife that the police released pictures of, well, it was a perfectly legal knife. As for the blood evidence, well, it was collected after the van was all over the place for an entire week. Tainted. Inadmissible, I would argue. Yet, the state really wasn't able to challenge any of it. They were between a rock and a hard place because of the knife. If they challenged the legality of the arrest based on the knife being legal, well, what about those hundreds of other knife cases they've prosecuted and continue to prosecute? And they certainly didn't land any punches from the blood evidence either, because it didn't go to prove or disprove when and how Freddie was injured and who was responsible. Now, we took a break in the long, involved ride the Baltimore Police Department gave Freddie Gray after arresting him to examine the very limited physical evidence that was actually gathered in this case. But when we return next week, we get back to that van ride. According to the official story, there were six stops in total before Freddie was finally transported to the Western District Station. But you know what? We're not too sure about that. Next time on Undisclosed.
Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 5, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marcia Chatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote the episode. Jason Henderson helped with the research for this episode, and Saad Chaudhry consulted. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. Methil Telhan is the super producer that brings everything together and makes sure that you get a new undisclosed podcast every Monday and Thursday at 6 p.m. Our sponsors ensure that we can continue to fund and produce this investigation, so we want to give thanks to our sponsors. Really, we do appreciate them. Our sponsors this week were Stamps.com, Blue Apron, and Latote. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed undisclosed theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website, and Baluki does our graphics. The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins drops every Thursday about 6 p.m. Make sure you check it out for a great discussion about this week's episode. Dee's ability to bring a new perspective to our investigation makes for some powerful audio. You're going to love it. Moreover, you're going to get some great context that helps round out this episode. Follow Dee on Twitter at DeeWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode using the hashtag FreddieGray or the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then...